Welcome to the Proceedings Podcast. I'm Bill Hamlet, the Editor-in-Chief of Proceedings at the U.S. Naval Institute. Today is Friday, TGIF, Friday, March 22nd. And in this episode, we're going to recap some significant naval news with Sam Lagrone from USNI News. But first, today's episode is brought to you by Booz Allen. Accelerate today's missions with tomorrow's technologies as the leader in providing AI solutions to the federal government and one of the world's largest cybersecurity providers. Booz Allen advances game-changing capabilities rapidly, ethically, and securely. Learn more at boozallen.com/defense. All right, let's get right to it with Sam Lagrone. Sam, welcome back to the show.
Hey, glad to be here.
All right, so it's an understatement to say it's been a busy week for the news, for the your team. Lots going on both operationally and programmatically. So let's start with U.S. forces that are headed to Gaza to help with the humanitarian aid mission. Let me try that again. The humanitarian aid mission off the Gaza Strip. So talk about the Army watercraft and the Naval Beach Group and other naval forces and how they're going to be used when they get there.
Sure. So last week I took two trips through the swamps of Virginia to go check out the operation that was announced by President Joe Biden during his State of the Union address, that the U.S. Military is going to build a humanitarian pier on the Gaza Strip, allowing a vector for aid to come in outside of the trucks that are at the border and then the airdrops that U.S. Central Command keeps doing. So the idea would be that you would move 2 million meals a day from unspecified ports. We think it's Cyprus, with Army watercraft to this pier. And the kind of the underlying message and the underlying promise from the Biden administration was no boots on the ground, no U.S. troops will be in Israel. So so far, there are two units that are designated to go. It's the U.S. Army's 7th Battalion, 7th Transportation Battalion Expeditionary. It's a unit underneath the 18th Airborne Corps. And so they're based at Joint Base Fort Eustis, or Joint Base Langley Fort Eustis, kind of in between Richmond and Newport News. So we went there last week to go see the Army watercraft off. So these are flat bottom boats. They draft about 12 feet or so. They top out at about 10 knots. And they're designed to do this joint logistics over the shore operation, where they have these kind of Lego type sections of pier. They call them the modular causeway system. And then you can load them up on trucks, you can load them up on train cars. And when you get to the other end of where you need to go, you can build a pier, you could build kind of a floating staging area. They call it a roll-on, roll-off discharge area, where you can go and assemble all of your stuff from your larger draft ships out in the sea, and then use Army watercraft to go and take them into shore on a pier. So 7TBX loaded up a MARAD ship, a Maritime Administration Ready Reserve ship called the Roy Benavidez, which just a few years ago had been transferred from the Navy to MARAD, with these modular components so they could go and build the pier. And that left yesterday from Newport News. So they floated these big chunks of pier 18 miles down the river from Fort Eustis down to the Newport News Port of Virginia terminal. And they loaded them up with cranes, got on board the ship last week, talked to the master. They had about 5 days warning. Him and the chief engineer were on vacation, and they were like, guess what? Load up. We're going to the Eastern Mediterranean. So that's the Army group, that's 7TBX. So they've had a series of watercraft that have departed. They're doing a very long Atlantic transit. It's 30 days at 10 knots in a flat bottom boat in the spring in the Atlantic, I think. Your viewers and your listeners know what the implications are. One of the chief warrant officers, who was the chief engineer on the lead ship, said, "Hey, I got to pack Dramamine every time. You know, half the time I got to brace my hand up against a bulkhead to keep from falling over."
Yeah, because of the weather. They're not doing like the Great Circle route, right? They're going a more southerly transit.
Right. They're doing a southerly transit, and it's going to take them about a month to get over there. So all told, we're not going to have the Army's not going to be there, and they're not going to have the pier assembled for about 60 days from last week. So it's going to take about another 50, 60 days for them to assemble the pier. The Navy's contribution, they're coming from Jacksonville. So Navy Beach Group 1, which is based out of San Diego, has a bunch of gear that is pre-positioned on ships in Jacksonville, Florida. So they have gear pre-positioned in the Pacific, and they have gear positioned in Jacksonville. So they're taking two other container ships. I'm sorry, not container ships, two cargo ships, the Lopez and the Bobo, and they're going to sail them across with the Navy gear. And so what the Navy's going to do is with their gear, which is very similar to the Army's, is they're going to build kind of a floating pier 2 miles off the coast of Israel. And that's where the cargo from the humanitarian mission that is screened in Cyprus, we think, is going to come. And then that's going to get transferred over to the watercraft from the Army. And then the Army is going to ferry that to the pier that they build in Gaza. Again, no boots on the ground. There's a lot of open questions, right, as to how does your force protection work? Who is going to be on the other side to actually tie off the pier and put a stake in the ground to make sure it doesn't float away, because you can't put boots on the ground? So a lot of those are still open questions. I mean, down to how does the command and control for this work? Because Israel is in the Mediterranean, right? So ordinarily that would be under the domain of U.S. European Command and NAVIR, Naval Forces Europe, Africa, out of Italy. However, within not too long, in the not too distant past, Israel is now part of U.S. Central Command, which is the Middle East Command. So there's some question as to how this is going to work, who's going to be in charge of what part of the operation, and then who is the partner on the other side. I think the U.S. has said that they are not going to work with Hamas. Well, does that mean that's IDF? That means there's some NGO. I think NBC, our colleagues over at NBC News, said that the Israeli government was contemplating doing a private security group, whatever Blackwater is called now. And so there's still a lot of moving pieces. So I think from the people that we talked to, I think half of them are sort of excited that, like, hey, we have an organization that's biased towards action and they're doing something. And about the other half is sharing a lot of concerns that, like, hey, there's a lot of open questions in this operation right now.
Yeah, so seen between EUCOM and CENTCOM, 6th Fleet, 5th Fleet there, a big seam where you've got a floating pier, it's something tied up to the beach in Gaza, but no U.S. boots on the ground. So how do you tie it up? How do you secure it? Will there be American service members on the pier, but not on the beach? Yeah, as you point out, lots of questions yet to be answered.
Yeah. So, I mean, what happens, you know, I mean, I think, you know, we're just kind of spitballing the other day with some colleagues. I think, what's the worst case scenario? A soldier gets kidnapped by Hamas. What's the second worst case scenario? Like, some civilians end up getting killed trying to rush the pier. I mean, there are a lot of ways this can go sideways.
Yeah, and then that's not even counting the potential for real bad weather. You know, those systems, that joint logistics over the shore, floating pier and things that are tied up to the shore, when you get heavy weather in the East Med, which often happens because the prevailing winds tend to blow that way, you know, it can get a little hairy. Yeah. All right. Well, let's move on to the second topic I wanted to talk to you about today, and that is shipbuilding and the Navy budget. The president's FY25 budget dropped a couple weeks ago, and you guys have covered that. And then the 30-year shipbuilding plan came out this week. What are some key takeaways for the future of the Navy from those two documents?
Sure. So let's start with the budget. So the budget, as always, comes with a 5-year outlook of what the Navy wants to buy. That's usually a pretty realistic assessment. So I think probably the biggest takeaway from this Navy's budget is that amphibious shipping is back in those plans. So this was a big kind of three-way struggle between the Pentagon, big Pentagon, the Navy, and the Marine Corps as to what is the appropriate number of amphibious ships, L-class ships, that you need to go and sustain the Marine Corps. So the Marines were very adamant. The Marines, as we all know, are very, very good at communicating with Congress. They have been for years and years and years and years and years. as to what their intentions are. And so the Marines were very adamant about, we need 31 ships is a minimum. And so General Berger, the former commandant of the Marine Corps, now General Smith, the current commandant of the Marine Corps, are very adamant about the fact 31 ships is the minimum. And you saw a lot of rhetorical arguments from the Marines last year, especially when you had some of the humanitarian crises that were going on in Sudan. For example, there was not an ARGMU, right, amphibious ready group, Marine Expeditionary Unit, you know, the floating three ship formation that goes to places and puts Marines around if they need them, evacuates people if they need them. There's a whole sort of doctrine that the Marines are very quick to tell you that they are there to make sure that they have the option to go and put forces ashore and then take people off if they need to. The Marines made quite a meal of that, not having those ships around Sudan at the time. And, you know, the ongoing conversation between OSD and Navy led to, all right, we give up. We're going to start building LPDs again. So San Antonio, there's a San Antonio Flight 2A, and the long-range shipbuilding plan is committed to a baseline of 31 amphibious ships. So that was probably a big win for the Marine Corps. The other thing that sort of stood out to a lot of people was the U.S. Navy is only buying one Virginia-class attack submarine this year. It's the first first Block 6 Virginia-class attack submarine. And usually that's a two-a-year thing. So the submarine industrial base has probably caused more concern than any other sort of shipbuilding topic in the last couple of years. So you have the submarine industrial base as it stands, built between two shipyards. You have General Dynamics Electric Boat up in Groton, Connecticut, and then you have Newport News shipbuilding by HII down in Newport News, Virginia. So the way that works and breaks down is the EB Electric Boat up in Connecticut, they build the barrel of the submarine, right? They build the central component, the central sort of hull of the submarine for both the Columbia class and then the Virginia class submarines. And then you have HII, and they build sort of the front ends, right? They build the bows, and then they build the sterns, and then they barge them back and forth between the two yards to assemble them together. And that's worked out pretty well so far. That was a teaming arrangement that was made back in the 2000s when the Virginia program got going, and it's worked out okay. Now, instead of delivering two submarines a year, and it was the Navy's most successful shipbuilding program for quite some time, but the fragility of the submarine base kind of was exposed, and some trends were accelerated by the lockdown and the pandemic, where you have a lot of older workers getting out of the game. You had supply issues. You had quality of life issues in certain yards for some people, and you saw a contraction of the workforce, saw a contraction in the supplier base. And now all of a sudden, instead of delivering two submarines a year, you're delivering 1.3 submarines a year. And that is coming as the Australians are getting involved with nuclear submarines as part of the Australia-UK-US agreement. And in order to meet all of the obligations that the U.S. Needs to make into that agreement, they need to be building 2.33333 submarines a year. It's a lot of wind up. I promise this is going somewhere. So the not buying two submarines a year kind of raised a lot of eyebrows with some people. And I think the Secretary of the Navy, Carlos Del Toro, would argue when they made this decision that, hey, the order books for HII and GD are stocked. We can go and take this submarine out of this plan right now because they have so much orders already stacked and they're so behind on their deliveries that we're going to put more resources into advanced procurement and then stabilizing the submarine industrial base. So as a part of the long range shipbuilding plan, you have about 17.5 billion ish in submarine industrial base support. And we're trying to get some more specifics, but they really want to go and make sure that not only with new construction, but with like existing submarines, they can go and get after some of this maintenance stuff.
Got it. So that's, you mentioned 2.333, that's fast attack submarines. That's the aspiration for fast attack boats per year. And then add to that one Columbia class per year that are supposed to be coming online as well. So was there any change in the shipbuilding, the shipbuilding projection for 30 years or in the budget related to Columbia class?
No. We did report, however, so the Secretary of the Navy has just completed a 45-day shipbuilding review. Secretary Del Toro has been pretty tough on the shipyards right now. And so he took, with a brand new chief acquisition official in the Navy now, Secretary Gerton, Nicholas Gerton, who just was the CAPE director. They did a 45-day shipbuilding review. It's like, well, we just need a status update on everything. So a lot of our questions around budget time were, you go, hey, wait for the 45-day review to come out. Well, one of the things that we found out was that the Columbia-class submarine, which is the not only the Navy, but the Pentagon's number one acquisition priority, is late. And it's going to be late maybe by a year. And that is one of the things that the Navy and the Pentagon really did not want to happen, because the way that these deterrent patrols are constructed, the Columbia was going to come online heel to toe when the Henry M. Jackson, which is the first SSBN to get decommissioned, comes out of inventory. And then the District of Columbia could slide right into that slot. Now that schedule is getting pushed a year. And the Navy's going to have to start asking some hard questions about how that's going to ripple through the rest of the submarine force. So that's the number one priority, again, for the Pentagon, is not only the Navy, but the Pentagon, is to get that right. And so everybody's scrambling to try and figure that out. Based on our reporting, the two things that have come up are the bow assembly coming out of HII is taking some time, taking longer than they thought. So again, in this teaming arrangement with Electric Boat is building the central part of the submarine, including the missile tubes that are going to carry the Trident II D5 ballistic missiles. And then HII is responsible for building the stern portion and then the bow. The stern just delivered in January. The bow is late. And it's a new type of construction, or it's not a new type of construction, but it's a new component build for HII, because it's essentially the old Ohio bow dome, but they never built the Ohio bow dome. So that's taking longer. The other component is the steam turbines that take the steam from the nuclear reactors and then turn it into energy for the rest of the ship is taking longer than they expected. And that's government furnished equipment. And so that's on the Navy to go and make sure that they can go and get that built and delivered in time, because there's, you know, when you're building the barrel of the submarine, you need those pretty early to get those in there, because it's difficult to put those in, these massive pieces of hardware in a pretty tight construction configuration.
Fascinating and troubling, because I know that for the last, at least three CNOs in a row now, we've been hearing from Admiral Richardson and then Admiral Gilday and now Admiral Franchetti that the Columbia class is our number one priority and it cannot slip. We cannot delay with this thing. So a year-long delay, as you said, puts all sorts of perturbations in ship schedules and things. Let's move on a little bit more about shipbuilding. So we're hearing that the Constellation class frigates are behind. Now the future USS Enterprise, which is a Ford class carrier, is going to be 18 months late. You reported on that this week. And then the Navy budget. Well, you already talked about the one fast attack submarine. So aside from the broader, the submarine issue, what else is happening with shipbuilding?
Well, the Constellation class frigate, which is the new small combatant for the Navy that comes in after the LCS, finishes their run. It's getting built up at Fincantieri Marinette Marine, which is a yard up in Wisconsin. So it's a yard that is having a hard time retaining a workforce. Based on a story that we wrote in January, the first Constellation, USS Constellation, was supposed to deliver in 26. Now that looks like it's going to be 27 or later. And I think a big part of that is going to be the workforce and getting that established. Also, it's a unique ship because it was based on a parent design. So think all the way back to 2015. The late Senator John McCain was very negative on the LCS program and wanted the Navy to look at a new ship. And sort of based, honestly, on his force of will, jump-started a new frigate program. And the idea on how it was supposed to work, it was based on a parent design. And so the parent design for this frigate is the French Frem, which is built by Fincantieri, which is an anti-submarine warfare frigate, which also has some guided missile components. It's a multi-mission frigate, but, you know, like most frigates, it's designed for anti-submarine warfare.
Yeah, the French and the Italian navies both have the Frem class. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Nice ship.
The French Frem. Yeah, they're great. The French Frem, I have been told, is the superior ship. But no offense to our Italian friends. But that design had to go through NAVC, and the biggest difference between European designs and American designs is the level of survivability that American ships have to have is so much greater than European ships. So you have to touch almost every single drawing. So you have this parent design from the ship that's already existing, but it's almost, depending on who you talk to, it's almost an entirely new ship design when it comes out the other end. And then you have some pretty rigid naval sea system command standards that they have to go and adhere to. So you have that design component on top of the fact that Fincantieri, who has been successful building the Freedom class littoral combat ships, is now building a new ship class. They also have are building a series of four multi-mission surface combatants for the Saudis as part of their their Eastern Naval upgrades. And so those ships are also in the yards. And then you have the old Freedom classes. So there's a bunch of stuff going on over in the yards already. And then you have sort of a workforce issue because rural Wisconsin, unless you're into the Green Bay Packers or the outside, can be a tough place to live. So there's a retention issue they have over there too. So that's all combining to pushing this frigate, which is a particular priority of Secretary Del Toro, back further.
Got it. Well, go then, Packers, but yeah, it is.
No, go Packers, go Bears.
Go Bears. It's cold as heck up there in the wintertime. And so, yeah, even inside a shipbuilding hall, it's not easy to do that, to bend steel. I wanted to go back just real quick. You mentioned the LPD San Antonio class and the fact that there had been a hold on building those ships, and now the new budget has broke forward. So there's another one. Is the plan to do one every other year?
I got to look at the build rate. It's not coming immediately to me, but the idea is, I want to say it's one every 3 years.
Okay.
So those are built down at Ingalls Shipbuilding down in Pascagoula, and they've been doing those. They've been chunking those out in a serial manner for a long time now. So it's been a pretty successful ship class for them. So now that they have the demand signal, they're gonna move and probably not have a ton of problems getting those out the door.
Gotcha. All right. I want to wrap up in the life well-lived category. We've got sad news this week that the 29th Marine Corps Commandant, General Al Gray, passed away. And your team covered that. What were some key changes in the Marine Corps during General Gray's leadership?
So General Gray, I think, you know, probably famously came up with the slogan, "Every Marine a Rifleman." There's a pretty famous Morley Safer interview with him in 60 Minutes, right when he took charge of the Marine Corps in the late 80s, where it's like, hey, you know, talking to a Lance Corporal with a big mustache, going like, this is going to get a lot harder. You're going to be in the field a lot more. So General Gray, you know, he's a Mustang, right? He was a sergeant during the Korean War before he commissioned and served, earned a Silver Star in Vietnam. And then moved it on to lead the Marine Corps. And the big thing that he brought leading the Marine Corps was this idea of maneuver warfare. Really, really pushing this idea of allowing the Marines to move wherever they needed to go, not be stuck in these kind of fix battles and really use the mobility of the service to bring a new dimension of hit, move, hit, move, hit, move to the service. That's probably his, out of the many contributions that General Gray made to the Marine Corps, that's probably going to be the most enduring, leading to warfighting, the warfighting manual, field manual number one in the Marine Corps, which is still a revered document to this day.
It very much is. It's debated, and there's some discussion. There's been discussion in our pages and proceedings about, you know, should it be updated? If so, how? And those are robust discussions. But you're right. That was a sort of seminal document, and happened under General Gray's leadership. And he was 95 years old when he passed away. Beloved leader of the Marine Corps. So rest in peace, General Gray. Well, Sam, this has been a great conversation. Before we sign off, any saved rounds from you?
Yeah. So, I'm glad you, gave me a shot to plug our new newsletter, the US Navy Sea Scroll. It is an exclusive Naval Institute member benefit. So as we kind of roam around the world, we want to put out stuff so people, can get a better understanding of what's going on with the Navy, the Marine Corps, and have some objective information and objective reporting. However, Naval Institute members deserve more. So we have put together a weekly newsletter that has a lot of tidbits and stuff from our notebook that don't make it into our reporting. And it's a really good way to get kind of some cogent analysis and some stories behind the stories for the Naval Institute members. So what's a digital membership? $42? That seems like a deal to me, Bill.
Yep, $42 is a digital membership for the Naval Institute. $69 gets you print proceedings plus online. But it was a great initiative by your team, Sam, to come up with this member only product, and we're very proud of it.
Oh yeah, we're having a good time. That's the most important part. It's a lot of fun to put together.
Yeah, and it comes out every Thursday. So if you're a member of the Naval Institute, you can get the Sea Scroll newsletter from the USNI news team, and it'll hit your inbox every Thursday. And it is unique to our members only. Good stuff. All right. Well, my guest today has been Sam Legrone. He's the head of the USNI news team. Sam, informative as always to talk to you. Hope you have a great weekend.
You too. Thanks for having me.
All right. Today's show was brought to you by Booz Allen. Accelerate today's missions with tomorrow's technologies. As the leader in providing AI solutions to the federal government and one of the world's largest cybersecurity providers, Booz Allen advances game-changing capabilities rapidly, ethically, and securely. Learn more at boozallen.com/defense. And until next week, remember, victory begins at the Naval Institute.